Welcome to this sensational episode of Coffee with Source. I am joined by my special guest, Jill Urbane, who is a social worker and a parent educator. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I hesitated on the last name. I told you I'm craving to put a little French twist on it.
You'd be surprised at the things that people have called me when they pronounce that. A lot of times I get Irving.
Oh, no.
I don't know where that comes from, but.
People see what they want to see, right?
Right, exactly.
So social worker and parent educator, that sounds fascinating. But I also want to explore the journey of you and your life and what led you to this, you know, this chapter, this season in your life now.
Absolutely. It's really funny when I look back at things, you know, you think you know what you want to do. And sometimes, I feel like all along, this was never on my radar to work with toddlers or any of that. That was never on my radar. I thought I was going to be a veterinarian. And then I realized I don't think I could put a dog or a cat down. So I was like, no. Then I thought, oh, I'll be a physical therapist. And somehow I just ended up in the field of social work. And I started out working in like mental health, working in psychiatric institutions, providing services to psychiatric patients. And from there, it tumbled into getting a job with the state of Michigan, which, you know, where I'm from, if you can get into the state of Michigan, it's a good job. You better take it.
Yeah.
So I ended up working in a prison. Yeah. So I ended up working in a prison for about 5 years with maximum security offenders, most of whom were between the ages of 14 and 18.
Wow.
And they were serving life sentences. It was a really interesting job. And I actually really enjoyed it. But then I got to the point where I was like, gosh, it's so sad that so many of these young men who are brilliant, but are using, I would always say, if you would only use just a quarter of the energy that you put into antisocial activities into pro-social activities, your life could have been so different because they were so smart.
Yeah.
But they came from traumatic backgrounds and isolation and limited resources and, you know, parents weren't available to them or dysfunction in the home. And I thought, well, maybe I can do something to help these kids not end up here.
Yeah.
So I went to be a protective services worker.
Okay.
I know you're like, yeah.
A real problem solver though. I like that.
And yeah, that was a really interesting job. I did that for about 8 years. And I learned a lot on that job. You know, you kind of have an assumption about what home lives are like for people.
Yeah.
When you're not in them. And then when you get in them, you realize how they can be so overwhelmed to not know how to get out of them. So I did that for a while. And then I started just kind of getting burned out. And a friend of mine's like, hey, there's this job over at the school. They're starting a new program working with infants and toddlers. And I was like, okay, I just need to get out. And so I went. And again, it was like the universe kind of nudging me, not on my radar. I had zero experience working with toddlers with developmental delays, but I pestered the special ed director. I called her every week for 2 months. Are you ready to hire me? Are you ready to hire me? Are you ready to hire me? And finally, I think out of desperation, she was like, yes. All right. You can have the job. Just stop calling me.
Stop calling. I love that.
That's what I've been doing for the last 20 years.
What a fascinating story. What did those teenagers who were incarcerated, what was their response when you would tell them, you know, you're brilliant. You have so much potential. If you only focused your energy on the right things.
Do you know, a lot of them would cry. Honestly, they would tear up. I mean, they just, so many of them were kind of like latchkey kids. I mean, their parents were working a lot of hours or their parents had substance abuse issues and were facing their own difficulties. So they just didn't get that time and attention that young kids need. And so many of them, I think about at the time that I was working there, I think 85% of the prison population was from the greater Detroit area.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That is
a big state like Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And were their parents allowed to visit them? Did you ever work with the parents and the kids together?
So here's the really sad thing about this, right? Out of all of those prisoners that I worked with, those young men, I was working with one. He came in when he was 15 years old for a double homicide, a drug deal gone bad while he was in a gang. And by the time I met him, he had actually, he was one of the older prisoners. He had actually been there about 15 years. Oh. And in that time he kept talking about his friends and how, you know, he needed his friends. And I pulled his file and he had had one visit in 15 years.
So everyone just abandoned him.
Yeah. And that I would say reinforcing
the belief.
Absolutely. So I would say that that was really the norm. There weren't very many of them who had consistent visitors. It was really quite sad.
Do you think that from a parent's perspective, it's because, you know, if you don't see it, you're not around it, then it's not true? Do you think they harbor a lot of shame and guilt? And
oh, absolutely. I think that is a big piece of it. And yeah, I think a lot of times it's like, well, I failed him. So what's the point? Or, you know, I tried to tell him what to do and he didn't listen to me. And, you know, it's just a cyclical pattern of a dysfunctional relationship, you know, the attachment, the bonding, the support, sending the positive messages, all those things that our kids need, especially now that we know more about the research based on social emotional development, especially in those first 3 to 5 years. You know, a lot of them weren't getting it. And it's not because the parents, you know, I've said this many times to people. It's not because the parents don't love their kids. Like even the family.
And we're back.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. So it's not that the parents don't love the kids.
Absolutely. It's just when you come from a background where you didn't, you know, we live what we learn as children a lot of times, right? So if you grow up in an environment where there's a lot of chaos, that tends to be what we experience as adults. It's our safety zone, the chaos, even though that sounds dysfunctional. It's kind of our comfort zone and what we've experienced. And so what I found was most of the parents that I worked with who were really struggling, they really, really loved their kids. They just didn't have tools in their toolbox to know what to do differently. I always use the analogy of like a hoarder, right? Like their house is just filled with junk and stuff, and they know they don't want it that way, but they just don't know how to get over that first step.
They don't know where to start.
Exactly. It's so overwhelming. Where do I start with moving forward? So I like always using the analogy, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. But even that's overwhelming if you don't know.
Absolutely. Over the years, I've come up with my own little phrase that I use with parents where I say, you know, we have parenting self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And when a parent is feeling overwhelmed and frustrated and unsure and anxious, it's, you know, low parenting self-esteem. And it's always related to the amount of tools that they have or don't have in their parenting toolbox.
100%. And we mimic our parents' behavior a lot of the times as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I want to be clear too, that there are those folks who can come from a really dysfunctional environment and completely turn it around.
Break the cycle, as we say.
Exactly. But that's a rarity. And they probably had somebody somewhere in their growing up that provided them with that safe zone, allowing them to develop that resiliency.
I love it. So you mentioned a lot of times, you know, this wasn't on my radar. The universe was kind of steering me, but we have to be open to receiving these signs and these nudges and have the willingness to follow the breadcrumbs. So have you always had this belief that the universe is guiding you, or what does that look like for you?
You know, honestly, I think that I've always kind of vacillated, you know, like there are times where I'm like, oh, this is what I'm meant to be, you know, what I'm meant to do. And then there were other times where it was clearly sending me a message. And I was like, no, that's not how I'm going to do this. That's not the right path. I'm going to go down this path. And then every single time, the path that I went down, that was the wrong one. And I knew it, you know, it deep in your gut, right?
Exactly. Tell me what to do.
Exactly. Or it's like, that's not what I want to do. Right.
Yeah.
Like for me, as I'm moving towards the end of my working career, my day job, right? Like I'm going to be able to retire soon. I've always had in mind, like, what am I going to do when I retire? I want to get out, but I want to keep doing what I'm doing. And so I'm like, oh, I'll do this when I retire, or I'm going to work on that when I retire. And no, it just keeps leading me to the same thing. Do what you're doing, but do it on a bigger scale. So that's why I started my parent coaching business and I'm writing a digital course, because I want to help more parents who are feeling overwhelmed and frustrated beyond the ones that I work with on a daily basis through my day job.
That's pretty special. When you work with parents, how much of the focus is on them, their upbringing, and their own trauma?
You know, it really depends on the family, honestly. The approach that I use, because I'm there primarily to help them get their toddlers moving forward in one or more areas of development. It's usually a language delay or a motor delay, but there's a lot of times behavioral issues going on. You know, toddlers are challenging. So I use a real holistic approach when I'm working with a family. I mean, we got to look at the big picture and start with the area that's draining their energy the most, even if that isn't their toddler not talking, if it's that they're facing housing issues or there's marital problems or they're lacking a support system, they don't have family supports. We start with wherever they're at, you know, fill their well, right? Because we can't give what we don't have. So it's really all about filling their well, and then ultimately giving them tools for that toolbox so that they can feel better about who they are as a parent and as a person.
And then that translates into their relationship with their children.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you feel that your well is full doing what you're doing now, even though you never imagined this?
Yeah, it's really funny because every time I work with a parent and there's an aha moment for them, I mean, it's just like angels are singing in the background. I really can't describe the feeling to have a parent. Like, I've been on so many visits where a parent just literally broke down crying because their child did something for the first time. Mm-hmm. And to be able to be there in those moments is just an absolute gift. And it definitely fills my well. And now looking back on it all the times, I was like, yeah, I like my job, but I want to do something else. I've just realized, no, this is really what I'm meant to do. And that's probably why out of all the jobs that I've had, this is the one that I've stayed at the most. All my other jobs, after like 5 years, I'm like, all right, I already know how to do this and it's not challenging anymore. And this job is just, maybe it is that piece that it's so fulfilling, but it's also kids and every family is different. Every child is different. There can be similar qualities going on or issues going on, but how they approach life is different. So I learn so much from each.
That's fascinating. And also the fact that you kind of, you know, reverse engineered the process. You started off with adults and psychiatric institutes. You went with, you know, teenage prisoners. So you've got the broader perspective on the outcome, and now you're helping people at the base.
Yeah. Isn't that funny how that happened?
Well, I think that's the best.
It is, isn't it? And like I said, never on my radar to work with young kids ever. It was always adults, you know, and then it was teenagers. And now I've found my jam. I love toddlers. I love toddlers. I think it's maybe too the energy that they have, right? They're just still so pure and emotional and genuine. I mean, they're a blank slate in the sense. And, you know, it's always a challenge to try to figure out how to rein them in a way where you don't squash that feistiness.
Yeah. And that's the problem a lot of times is we're told, you know, we're told what to do. We're told what is right. We're told what is wrong. And so we grow up with all of this noise in our head, but that feistiness, that energy, that insatiable curiosity that we have is so easily dimmed, right? Through our formative years of, what is it, 2 to 7 years old or Absolutely. 2 to 9 years old. So when we don't realize that as parents, right?
Absolutely.
And I always realize it when we're in it, that we're squashing their curiosity.
I do tell parents frequently, because they're like, oh, he's so strong-willed, or oh, he's so challenging. And I'm like, well, I want you to look at that through a different lens. That quality is going to take him far in life. You want a kid who's motivated to work for the things that he wants. So in those moments where you're overwhelmed by it, like, oh, he's driving me crazy because he keeps pushing me, that's good. You just have to figure out how to help him know when enough is enough in a way that still encourages him to want to keep doing it in a different way.
Mm. And how do parents react when they learn those coping mechanisms?
You know, I think they really light up that to realize, and it's, you know, 80% is about mindset, right? 20% is about the work that we do. And if we just look at the things that are going on in our lives through a different lens, you know, I mean, they're more, it's an opportunity when we get challenged, you know, like over the last 2 years in particular with the pandemic, you know, figuring out how to do what I do online, right? And supporting families has been a challenge. And of course, then dealing with everything that's going on as a person in my home and with my family, I really had some really, really dark points. And I've always been a really strong, optimistic, move forward, fix the problem kind of person. But I really hit a glitch, particularly last year, where I think it was like the first year I was trying to maintain everybody in my household's, you know, mental health and get them through it. And then they all came out and they're fine. And then it was like, it finally hit me and I hit that dark spot. But what came out of that dark spot was a realization that I need to do and plan for something else. And I meant to do something bigger. And that's why my theme for 2022 is service to others. I'm just going to give it all away. Everything I know.
Yeah. Why does that resonate with you so deeply?
You know, I don't know. I think honestly, it's something that I've always known, but I've just, you know, it's again, that universe, right? It's always been there. I've always been destined to do something that helps others. And I pushed it down and was going about it the wrong way for a long time, you know, or not really realizing how big and broad it needed to be. Like, I've always had visions of myself on a large stage in front of a group of people, right? Well, that's why I became a musician, because I thought that's what that vision meant, right? That I'm supposed to be a performer.
Yeah.
No, that's not the vision. That's not what that vision meant. That vision meant I'm supposed to speak to large groups of people to try to give them some tools. Because now what I've learned over the years is, even though I might be saying a lot of things that other professionals in the field are saying, there are some people that are going to connect with the way that I present that message.
100%. I feel like that too. You know, I feel like especially in the last 2 years, 2.5 years, the amount of coaches and holistic therapists that have popped out of the woodwork is overwhelming. And when you sit in that comparative space and you start to see these people who have just the grandest and biggest personalities and the budgets for marketing, and they've got all of their crap together, and you're going, well, what could I possibly have to offer? And you have to bring it back to, we could be 10 people in one room saying the absolute same thing, and it's going to resonate differently with different people. But that's tricky to overcome.
It is that imposter syndrome, and I think it's a daily basis, isn't it? I feel it on a daily basis.
Yeah. Yeah. I catch myself oftentimes, you know, just having this inspired thought and then wanting to, you know, make a video or go online and then go, well, I'm sure someone's gonna, you know, have the same thing. And then I catch myself and then I say, no, you know, you've lived through this, so you're sharing your perspective. But it's tricky.
It is, you know, and so I'm a big fan of journaling. I journal every single morning. I write down my affirmations every single morning to kind of try to overcome and push down those imposter, have an easier way of pushing down the thoughts of imposter syndrome and knowing that this is what I'm meant to do. And one of those statements every day is, I am meant to serve others.
Oh, I love that. And it anchors us in.
It really does. It's funny, the days when I wasn't journaling consistently, I've always, you know, kind of intermittently done it, and then I'll fall off the tracks, right?
The journaling wagon. Yeah,
exactly. But I found that now that I've been really consistent over the last 2 months in particular, it really is a big mind shift for the day. It really sets the tone for the day, and I'm more productive for the day. And when those thoughts come in, it's so much easier to push them out.
Yeah. I love that, setting the intention. Going back to your experience working in prisons, I'm fascinated with that. But you said at one point that it was overwhelming to see that there's not much that you could do. And so, you know, it became emotionally difficult for you. But does that stay with you? Does that cause you some type of trauma or emotional burnout where, I'm not sure if you froze for a second.
I did. I'm gonna turn my video off. Maybe that will help with the connection.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Okay. Can you repeat that question?
Yeah, of course. I'm just curious to know, when you're working in the prison system and you're seeing these kids with all of this potential, and you're going through the data and you're seeing that, you know, a lot of them are not receiving visitors, what kind of emotional toll does that play on you? And does that stick with you sometimes? Does that come back to revisit?
Absolutely. I honestly think of many of the prisoners that I work with on a regular basis, you know, because they did some heinous, awful, unimaginable things, but yet they were still human beings, right? Who also still had some real wonderful qualities. Like I used to do, we had a cognitive restructuring program that I was a part of in the prison. So I had like two or three different groups of offenders that every week we would meet for this group. And it was really about delving down to their core beliefs and their emotions and how that led to thinking patterns that were destructive, and then going in and dissecting those to try to build more positive pro-social thinking patterns. And there was one particular group of lifers, they were never going to get out, that it was a small group that we had. And when I got pregnant, they went to the store and bought me a congratulatory card, and they all signed it, and I still keep it. It was just, I was just blown away.
Wow.
That this group of men who were never going to get out of prison, you know, went out and got me a card saying, congratulations on your pregnancy. We're really, really happy for you.
But isn't that the power of connection?
Man, it is so true. You know, and I think sometimes we really, you know, make assumptions about people or underestimate people. And yeah, I was really, really touched by that. They also gave me a goodbye card where the whole unit signed the card, which is crazy that all of these maximum security men signed a card, and they had such positive things to say. It was really a great job. I learned a lot, especially about not making assumptions about people, and also being able to recognize we've all made mistakes in our lives, but we all deserve to be treated with dignity, respect, and grace.
And do you believe that for me, I think that's part of what's flawed about the system. You know, when you make that, I want to say mistake, even though it's horrendous and you've hurt a lot of people, but that you make this mistake at 14, 15 years old, that your circumstances aren't factored into the equation when you're being sentenced. And so to spend your entire life in prison, repaying your debt to society, for some reason, that doesn't necessarily sit well with me.
Yeah, it's a really challenging, the system is broken. You know, I mean, we need to be more proactive in helping these kids before they end up in that situation.
Proactive. And if they are, you know, in that situation, then what are the processes put in place and implemented to help them reintegrate society or have the opportunity to live some type of a normal life? Because at 15, our brain isn't fully developed yet.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I honestly believe that many of the things that we are facing in our country, all of the difficulties and challenges that we have, if we went back to strengthening families, our world would be a much different place. Somewhere we got away from the whole idea of really helping families and supporting families. And, you know, I get frustrated sometimes with folks of my age and older, I'm in my 50s, who are like, well, parents nowadays just need to this, and they need to be tougher with their kids, or they need this. And it's like, you don't really know what it's like. I mean, I'm in their home every week, and I know what they're facing, the challenges they're facing, working 2 and 3 jobs and working alternate shifts so that they don't have to pay for unaffordable daycare because they don't want their child in somebody else's care, or kids that are in care from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., not because parents want it that way, but because they have to work 2 jobs just to pay the minimum on their bills. Yes. So
that's
really
not
feel like
into effect the medical, you know, the cost of medical care if the child has special needs, and
all
so
of
many
it.
Factors. But you know, the ideal recipe would be to help parents as you're doing, right? Help them, give them the tools, but also teaching parents emotional competence before becoming parents.
Yeah, you know, I always say you have to have a license to drive, you have to have a license to fish.
I say that all the time too, Jill. I say that all the time. You know, you have to be a certain age to vote. You have, there's all these rules and regulations just to adult and you know, live life. And yet, you know, we can all have babies and take them home. And I don't want what I'm saying to be misunderstood, but
absolutely.
if we were taught emotional competence, I know that I would have saved myself a lot of heartache and a lot of heartache for my children had I been educated about parenting, what it is. And we all kind of joke, right? Oh, there's no manual to do this.
Right.
Let's learn as we go. But I mean, there's hundreds and thousands of years of data, right? Going back in history on how to be a parent. So there should definitely be a manual or some type of course to teach us basic emotional competence before we bring another life and human being into this world.
Absolutely. And you know, there's a resource out there that is in every state in the United States called Parents as Teachers. Ooh. And it is, I'm telling you, because I was trained in the curriculum when I first started my current position, and there aren't enough parents that know about it. They will work with parents who are pregnant and haven't even had their child yet. And the whole program is designed to help parents understand the brain science, which to me is one of the keys that I have found over the years, that when parents understand, have a greater understanding of how brain development happens, parents are more likely to be like, oh, okay, well, let me change what I'm doing here, because now I understand that this is going to help with this skill later on.
100%.
And that's what the Parents as Teachers program is all about, helping understand all of the different areas of development. And they'll work with parents coming to their home once a month, doing an activity with them and their child, and they'll stay with that family up until the child is five, and it's free of charge.
Wow. I haven't heard of this, and I've spoken to many professionals over the last year and I had similar conversations, and I've never heard of this program.
It's an amazing program. It's in every state in the country. At least it was when I was originally trained. I don't know if funding has had any impact on that, but their whole goal is to help teach parents, teach their children so that they can be ready to hit the door for kindergarten.
That's so cool. I feel
Isn't
like that's
awesome?
Something, yeah, that's a business card that every OBGYN should have in their office. It's like, oh, yes. Congratulations, you're pregnant. Here you go. This is the next step. You need to take this course now.
Absolutely. And the cool thing is that, you know, once they get assigned a parent educator, they build that relationship with them. They're going to know this person for up to 5 years, as long as they're participating in the program. And having that person to be able to say, well, this is what's going on with that. And, you know, this is what you can do to encourage this. It's just such a gift. I really wish that when I had my first, this program was around, because I totally would have been all over it.
And that brings me to my question. How has the work that you've devoted your life to impacted you, you know, in a positive or negative way as a parent?
Oh my gosh. I think that, well, first of all, I have to say that my mess is my message. I found the early years of being a parent and having a toddler and a preschooler really, really, really challenging. I was a hot mess. I didn't know what I was doing. I had a smart and sassy kid that pushed every button. Mm. You know, I had a daughter with a speech delay. And so out of that mess, I thought, you know, I've got to do better. I've got to be better. And I got to work doing my research, and, you know, I took what I learned and now I share it with all of the families that I work with. So, you know, my experience is not just as being in people's homes and seeing what they're going through and struggling with, but I've been in their shoes. Yeah. Every parent that I meet who is like sobbing on the floor because they don't think that they can do it and that they're messing their kids up for life. I can't tell you how many times I sat in my room at night sobbing myself to sleep because I thought, what am I doing to these little people? What kind of humans are they going to turn into?
And it's true. I remember, you know, vividly going to lock myself in my bedroom closet when they were little. And I knew they were safe, and just bawling and thinking, who the hell let me leave with these tiny humans?
I know.
How dare they?
I got to share a story. I remember when my son was just about three, and he was an early talker and super, super smart and super, super feisty. And he challenged me. Ooh, did he challenge me? He was being particularly lippy one day, and I went into his room and I took everything out except the sheets on his bed, you know, his bedding and his clothes. And I called him into the room and I said to him, see what happens when you're sassy with mom? I took all of your toys. And he looked at me and he said, that's okay. I don't need any of that stuff. Oh my God. He wasn't even three. I was just like, I could feel like the blood coming up from my feet and the red flowing across my face. And I just walked out, went into my room, locked the door, and cried for about 2 hours thinking, this kid is smarter than me. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Those are the moments.
Oh, they are the moments.
Yeah. My eldest is 16. And I, you know, I had this conversation last week with someone where I said, you know, I am grateful. And I'm also terrified because he's smarter than I am. He's sharper than I am. And he knows exactly what buttons to push. And he knows exactly what to say and how to say it. And it's not always in a lippy or sassy way.
Right.
You know, but it's just like overwhelming that the amount of, and that's what we were talking about before, not wanting to squash their curiosity, but the, you know, what that's resulted to, his insatiable curiosity, his strong-willedness now has turned into this ability to challenge me like no one other.
And isn't that funny? I mean, because it makes us, I think having kids helps us redefine who we are, or who we thought we were, right?
100%.
Like, you know, like I thought I could handle this no problem. I'm a social worker, for heaven's sakes. I, you know, I've been doing behavior and development forever, but when it's your own.
Oh yeah. When you're faced with it.
I always say having kids is like taking your heart out and putting hands and feet on it and watching it walk around, and you don't want it to fall or get bumped or anything like that. And then it does these things that are hurtful. And you're like, why are you saying that to me? Don't you know how much I love you?
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, this is part of, you know, part of the conversation that I was having last week was questioning the fact that, is it possible for us to grieve and mourn certain parts of our expectations as parents, right?
Oh, it's wow. Like, that's a great point. Yeah. That's a great way to look at it. Absolutely.
And we don't, you know, I was looking back at the last 16 years of parenting with my son. And again, because he challenges the status quo on a daily basis without effort. Right. And I was thinking about all of these, you know, especially the last 2.5, 3 years, but mostly since the beginning of the pandemic, and how my relationship with him has changed, my vision for him, of him, all of the ways that I thought his, you know, the directions that I thought his life would go into, how our family would interact, and all of those things as parents, we don't necessarily take the time to grieve and mourn the fact that those were our expectations for our children.
Right. Wow. And that brings up a really great point. It's like, you know, there's a challenge with every stage. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, just about the time you think, okay, we're getting through this, some new thing pops up. And I got to tell you, my kids are 20 and 23. It doesn't even stop there.
It doesn't
stop there. It just is a constant evolving learning process. And in some ways, I think as they do get older, it really, and I'm not trying to bum any parents out there out, but it becomes even more challenging because you have less say. You know,
you have less say, and that's the point. You have less say, and then you have to do the inner work. You have to start excavating what it is about that particular situation and them not necessarily going in the direction that you'd planned for or saved for or hoped for or been coaching for, and what that says about you, and that why that's so important to you, and all of the emotions that are attached, you know.
Exactly.
Relinquishing the need to control the outcome and just sort of easing into the fact and trusting that we've guided them to the best of our ability, that we've given them the tools they need to succeed. But sometimes we do, it feels like a big blow.
Absolutely. And you know what, that is one of the things that I always, it sticks in my mind from my mom. She always said, if you throw enough mud at the wall, some of it's going to stick. So you gotta, as a parent, you gotta throw lots of mud at that wall. And it's funny when you don't think it's sticking, and then you hear your kids say things to their friends or to other people that it's like, yeah, well, and that's you hear what yourself. I said. And you're like, good, some of it's stuck. Okay, great.
Oh yeah. And I'm like, validation. Yes. I went through a particularly rough patch, and I felt like he hated everything about me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure if you experienced that through those teenage years where it felt like everything was a criticism about who I was fundamentally to my core. And it just felt like this deep hatred of of who I was. And of course they say things and the hormones and all of this stuff and
yeah,
is happening. And now full circle, exactly as you said, you know, I hear him say something to someone or, you know, take care of his girlfriend in a particular way. And I just have this smile. Of course I hide my smile, but I'm like, oh, I taught him well, you know, some of it stuck.
Absolutely. And you know, it's funny because it's an interesting stage that teenagers are going through in particular, right? They're, that happens because they have to start to disconnect from us, right? So they move away from the connection from us as parents, and they move that connection more towards their peers. And that's because they're trying to prepare for leaving the nest, so to say, right? And to move on to having other adult interactions. And so, you know, when they say those hurtful things, know that first of all, they don't mean them, right? But it's just
like you don't know that process. While they're saying it. And even if you try to know, you don't know and you question it.
I know.
And you know, cry. And yes, we're still crying when they're 16 and 17 locked in our
closet. Oh gosh, yes. And you know, I got to share something that this helped me through a lot of rough times with my kids. Back when I was a CPS worker, I went out on a call with a therapist to see this parent who had, it was a single dad with two boys that were really giving him a difficult time. They were teenagers and the dad was just really hurt by so many things that were going on. And the therapist said something that stuck with me to this day. He said to the dad, the number one rule of parenting is you can't take anything they say or do personally.
Okay. Well, that needs to be said the day we leave the hospital.
I know. But he's, you know, he went on to say, you know, everything that they're doing it with you because you're the safest person for them to try these things out with. 100%. You know, 100%. And so.
And exactly. And a social worker said to me, and it's very similar in that changed my whole perspective as well. Exactly. She said, they feel the safest with you. Mm-hmm. And they know because you've exhibited time and time and time again, that no matter how hard they push you and no matter how hard they think they want to push you away, that you still love them unconditionally.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. So they will test and they will test and they will test, because if they're feeling rejected or abandoned or hurt in other areas, they're bringing that home to you to see mm-hmm. and to test you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So if there are any expectant mothers listening to this episode, we're sorry. Sorry, not sorry, but this is the best conversation for you to hear, because it's like, this is reality. And there are resources available out there to help you cope at every stage. You just have to get curious enough to seek them out.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that like the process that I've used over the years is to educate myself about what's going on at all of the different developmental stages, right? To understand the brain part, because that's a piece too, is that sometimes we have expectations for our kids and we're like, why are they doing this? And why can't he understand this? And why does he, you know, fight against me understanding what's going on with the brain sometimes? Like we had a 15-year-old working at a restaurant. My husband was like, he's always been such a great kid. Now all of a sudden he just stands there. He doesn't know what to do. And it's like, well, his brain is flooded with all sorts of stuff right now. So following directions,
he's probably
in love. Right. Well, and you know, initiation, when they've got all of this other stuff going on, their brain isn't thinking about, oh, I should go look at the to-do list. He's like, I constantly have to tell him what to do. And I like, then let's build a system that helps him with where his brain is at right now.
That's so true. And it's meeting them where they are.
Yes. That is really the key.
Yeah, I love it. Do you have any tips or, you know, parting words of wisdom for parents who are listening on how they can start to maybe meet their kids where they are?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is to just really be more of an observer, right? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times we kind of get into the role of wanting to talk too much. We need to listen more and watch more, you know, give them that space for that. And then, you know, but sometimes we don't know what to say or do. It's okay. You know, take that moment and, you know, figure it out, get online, do some Googling, or just sit back and reflect with a cup of coffee. Like, wow, how can I handle this situation or this behavior in a way that allows us to connect, learn, and move forward?
I love that. And depending, you know, what age your kids are, it's okay to say, that's a really great point, or that's a really great question. I'm going to circle back and come back to you. I need to think about this.
I was talking with a mom the other day, and she had a really awesome strategy that I loved. She called it a redo. And this is for older, you know, older kids, But she said, if me and one of my children have an argument about something or a discussion about something and it doesn't go well, we offer each other a redo.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Isn't that great? I thought that was so insightful. Great.
And also, I think we're setting unrealistic expectations by, you know, imposing all of this pressure on ourselves, but also teaching our kids that we have the answers to everything, that we know exactly what to do in every situation, and that we've got, you know, all of the shit under control all the time when we don't, when we're hiding and we're crying in the closets. Right. So, you know what? We're teaching our kids that it's not okay not to be okay. And we need to kind of flip the script on that and teach them that it's okay not to know or not to know how to react. And it's best to just, you know, sit with it for a minute. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely love that. Can you tell our listeners where they can learn more about you and your programs and all of that?
They can find me at thementormomblog.com.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much, Jill, for being here and having this awesome conversation with me today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.